are back. We have Daniel Rowe with us now, who's going to be going over tax topics for game developers. All right, Dan, the stage is all yours.
Okay, great. Thank you, Ashley. I appreciate it. Thank you for having me, and thank you everyone for being to talk about this, which for some people may be fascinating, like for me. For others, it's a topic that you try to avoid and really causes a lot of frustration or potentially boredom. So what I'm going to try to do is at least keep it interesting. I hope that you walk away with some facts or something that is helpful in your business or in a business that you're thinking of creating. And I'll take questions at the end. So I have just a general disclaimer up here. Part of this is because what I talk about today is going to be general information that you can take and apply as you see fit. But if there's things that are specific to your business or your matters, those are things that I encourage you to reach out to a CPA or to a tax attorney to get specific advice on. So this is just general as an overview. And just a quick introduction of myself. So I'm a CPA and a tax attorney, and I practice out of Charlotte, North Carolina, although I work with clients all around the country. I do just U.S. tax, so nothing internationally, but everything is U.S. based. And I say I have a complicated relationship with tax work. And this is because, just like most people, I don't enjoy paying taxes, and I get a headache or frustrated with figuring out how some things work sometimes. But at the same time, I'm extremely fascinated with taxes. I'm fascinated by how the policies work, how they shape behavior. And that's some of the things that I want to talk to you about today at the beginning of this talk. So a little bit about my practice. I work primarily with creative people. So that is, I work with a number of game developers across the country from Philadelphia to LA. And I work with people in creative fields. So illustrators, artists, musicians, and then also people that do professional services. So I work a lot with doctors and therapists and things like that. And my goal here today is really to help you feel empowered around taxes. So you do what you do and you're great at it. And it's a lot of creative work, a lot of interesting hard work. And I want you to also feel though that you have a good handle on some of the financial aspects, particularly the tax effects of your business or your endeavors. So my goal really is to help you feel some empowerment and some baseline knowledge that you can walk away with. And today's conversation is really kind of three parts. In the first one, I'm going to talk about the history of creative taxation. I think this is where I get into things that are just fascinating to me as far as how taxes have shaped behavior and how behavior shaped tax policy. So we'll talk about that a little bit. And then we'll talk about starting your business. And what this covers is I will talk a little bit about being an employee versus an independent contractor and what that means from a tax standpoint. And then I'll talk about choice of entity. So that is a really big topic when you go to start a business, or you may already have one in existence, but we may suggest that you change it to a different form. And so I'm going to talk about what those different choices are for the type of entity that you can own. And then lastly, we'll talk about running your business. And here we'll talk about deductions and credits and state tax implications and some other interesting topics. So before we jump right into it, I always put this quote in front of my talks that I do to general audiences that are not tax people, because I think this helps set the stage that the genius, the renowned Albert Einstein is quoted as saying, "The hardest thing in the world to understand is the income tax." And I agree with this. I do think while we will talk about income taxes mostly today, there are many, many other types of taxes as well. And we'll touch on a couple of those. And some of those are in the examples that I'm going to show you now. So, well, actually, before we get to that, I want to set the stage here with how policies or rules or procedures impact behavior and how people respond to those rules. So two examples I like to use are Charles Dickens and Alexandre Dumas, the famous authors. And the story is that Charles Dickens was paid actually by the installment. So a lot of his novels, before they were novels bound in books, they were serial episodes, if you will, that were printed in magazines, one at a time on a monthly or some kind of recurring basis. And it's been said that he was paid based on the number of installments. And so that is some incentive for him, and part of the reason why some of his novels are so long and so intricate and just stretch on and on was to maximize the number of installments that he could get out of them. And similarly, Alexandre Dumas, who wrote The Count of Monte Cristo and the Three Musketeers, well, he was paid by the line of his writing. And that helps explain why a lot of his writing are short, choppy sentences, just one after the other after the other. So short lines, as opposed to long flowing paragraphs. And so his writing style was influenced by the rules that were in place for how he would get paid. Similarly, tax is a creative world as well. Taxes have often and way, way, way throughout history, going back thousands of years, shaped human behavior. And this is both intentional and unintentional. We'll talk about both, an example of both. And when we think about taxes today, especially income taxes, we think of it as a revenue generating policy. So income tax is in place to create revenue for the government to be able to spend it on things for the public good. But it's not just a revenue raising endeavor. It's also a way that politicians and that government can influence society. And so what typically happens is laws get put in place around taxes. Creative people find ways to work around those laws. So they find loopholes or find exceptions. And then the lawmakers add more complexity and add more rules to try to prevent some of those workarounds and loopholes. And the cycle just keeps on repeating to the point where now we're at a place where I use the income tax regulations on a regular basis. And these are rules and regulations that the Treasury Department has put in place for how the income tax code should work. And these regulations, I have them in printed books. It's 8 volumes long, and the pages are very, very thin with very small writing, and it's still over 80,000 pages of regulations just related to the income tax. And that's just one piece of authority that we use. So there's many other sources of tax law, but just for that example, the regulations are 80,000 pages. So it's just tons and tons of information to go through. And what we do as advisors is distill that down into a way that's useful for you as a business owner or as an employee or a freelancer. And so just a couple of examples of creative responses. So as I mentioned, there are other things besides income taxes. And throughout history, governments have imposed taxes on a number of different things. So even at one point in Russia, there was a tax on beards. And the idea was they wanted to encourage people to be clean shaven. And so they were taxed on the length of their beard. Well, also in Poland in the 1600s, the government wanted to come up with a system for how to tax its residents. And they decided to do it based on the width of buildings. And the theory being that the wider and larger the building is, when you look at it straight on, the more money that owner has, or the more resources, and the more tax they should be able to pay. So they would measure the width of the building and use that to compute the tax that was due from that owner. So what people started doing in response to that was, instead of building normal looking buildings, they started building them very, very thin, but very, very deep. So they would have the same square footage as they used to, but instead now they were very thin buildings and presumably generated less tax. And while this was in the 1600s, this also took place in other time periods and in other countries. And you can still see evidence of that in places like Poland and some of these other countries. So another example is England in 1696 used windows as a way to tax their residents. Again, the theory is that the more windows a building owner had, the more wealth they had or the more resources. And so the number of windows were used to compute tax. What did people do in response? They started building buildings without windows. They either closed them up, or they just built them without any windows, or with very few. Well, this ultimately led to health problems because lack of ventilation, lack of sunlight, different things that resulted from not having windows. And the government, instead of doing anything to prevent people from building that way, they decided to just repeal the tax. And so they did away with the window tax. And that was an example of people responding to a rule by building with less windows, and then the government responding back to that by repealing the tax. And there's a lot of examples of how this works. One more that I'll touch on, just that you can see here visually, is England did at one point have a tax on bricks and tiles. And you can actually, if you walk through certain parts of England today, you can see, based on the architecture, a building that was built before the tax on bricks and one that was built after, because the ones before the tax were built using many bricks. So smaller ones, all different sizes. They were more concentrating on the aesthetics as opposed to the size of the bricks. Once this tax came in place and they were now going to be taxed on the number of bricks used in a building, they started working with much larger bricks to have less tax to pay. And again, you can see this in this example, there's two buildings side by side, one built before the tax and one built after. And you can clearly see the difference in brick size. So another thing that the tax code and tax system is used for is to shape legislative, presumably society's priorities. And just a couple quick examples of that. So back in the US in the 80s, during the so-called war on drugs, there was a lot of legislative policy directed against drugs or against illegal drug activity. And so in the 80s, there was a section of the tax code put in place that denies deductions for any business that is operating in the field of selling controlled substances. And this includes marijuana or cannabis. And that seemed to not have much of an effect back in the 80s when they put it in place. But now in the US, we have over 30 states with legal cannabis industries. And the effect of this law from the 80s is that those state legal businesses have to recognize all their revenue, but they can't deduct most of their expenses. So even though they may, on a cash flow standpoint, end up breaking even or even having a loss, they still, for tax purposes, often show profit and then have to come up with money to pay the tax. So that is an example of society's priorities that were one thing at one time now have changed, but the tax law has not caught up with that. Similarly, we as a society incentivize clean energy by giving tax credits for clean energy equipment. And we also prioritize home ownership. So people that buy their house and have a mortgage are able to deduct the interest expense on those mortgages, but people that rent their residence are not able to get a deduction. So there is more favoritism or more incentive to own a house as opposed to renting it, just from a tax standpoint. And very quick history of the US income tax, because it hasn't been around for that long, but it has grown enormously in the short time that it has been around. So it first came to be during the Civil War, and it was purely a means to finance the war itself. So the government put an income tax in place, used that revenue to pay for supplies and armies and to pay for everything related to the war effort. And then after the war was over, there wasn't much support for an income tax in the country, and so they actually repealed the law. So it went away for a while until there was, again, a need for revenue generation. And so Congress passed an income tax in 1894 of 2% on income over $4,000. Now, the issue with this was it went up through the court system and it was held to be unconstitutional, that Congress could not pass a law mandating income tax on its citizens. It was just against the Constitution. So what happened to work around that was that eventually in 1913, an amendment was passed. So actual constitution was amended with the 16th Amendment, and that gave Congress the power to put an income tax in place And that's the income tax system that we have today. It started in 1913 and has evolved with many large changes since then. And again, as I mentioned, a huge growth in the amount of material that it encompasses. So today we're going to primarily talk about three types of taxes. Most of what I'll talk about involves income tax. And right now that ranges from 0% up to 37% on an individual. Corporations pay income tax up to 20 at a flat 21%. And then states also have income taxes. Not every state does, but most of them do. And they range, again, from zero for the states that have none, all the way up to 13.3% for people in California. So putting those two together with the 37 and the 13, you get a very high 50% tax rate on income in the US if you're a California resident. We'll also talk a little bit about payroll tax and how that comes into play for employees and independent contractors. And then if we have time, we'll talk about sales tax briefly. And if we don't have time, it is in your materials. And so you can take a look at the slides at your convenience. So first thing I want to talk about in terms of income and payroll tax is the distinction between an employee and an independent contractor. And I intend for you to look at it from two different ways, depending on which one is relevant to you. So you could look at it from the way of the worker, the person doing the work, whether you should be classified as an employee or an independent contractor and what that means to you. Or you can look at it from the standpoint of the employer or the company that's hiring you and whether they should be treating its workers as employees or independent contractors. And there's big differences in both of those. This schedule here or this slide shows some of the major differences comparing an employee to an independent contractor. And the first one, for an employee, if you're an employee, you're only paying half of the payroll tax yourself. It's withheld from your check and it's paid into the government. But the other half of the payroll tax gets paid by the employer. So this is important for employers to know that if you have an employee, you should be paying withholding half the payroll tax from their paycheck and then also coming up with your own money to pay the other half of the payroll tax out of your own funds. And as an taxes are generally withheld from your paycheck, so they're automatically withheld and paid into the government on your behalf throughout the year, as opposed to an independent contractor who has to make their own quarterly tax estimated payments throughout the year. So the government doesn't really or allow people to just wait till you get to the end of the year, see what your income is, then calculate your tax, and then pay it in. Instead, they require you to make estimates of what your income is going to be throughout the year and then pay tax on those estimates on a quarterly basis. So big difference between employee and independent contractor. Some of the other differences have to do with benefits. So if you have an employee or if you are an employee, then you're often eligible for health insurance through your employer, through a retirement plan coverage, and benefits like sick days and life insurance and other things that an employer would offer. Whereas if you're classified as an independent contractor, you're on your own for all those things. So if you take a sick day, then you're not getting paid. You're on your own for health insurance and for retirement plan contributions. So those are downsides. On the plus side as an independent contractor is you can deduct your business expenses. So things that are related to generating your income can be written off against that income to reduce your taxes. And one other thing I'll point out now, just at a high level, is that as an independent contractor, instead of an employee, you might be able to get a state tax deduction, which we'll talk about when we talk about different types of entities. And you might be able to get what's called a Section 199A deduction. And what the 199A deduction is it allows you to take 20% of your income off the top before you pay tax. And then you pay tax on the remaining 80%. This is potentially possible for independent contractors, depending on how they form their business, but it's not available to employees. So a lot of big differences between the two. There's not necessarily a overall one is better than the other, but it really comes down to your specific situation. And you want to make sure that you are classifying your people properly, or if you are the worker, being sure that you're classified properly and ideally in a way that makes the most tax sense to you. I'm not going to get into the details of this slide, but it is there for you to look at your convenience. But this is really how you tell if you have an employee as opposed to an independent contractor. The distinction, as you saw in the previous slide, is important for many reasons. But one lingering big reason why the business owner cares whether they have an employee or an independent contractor is because if they have an employee, they need to be withholding and paying in payroll tax for them. If they treat that worker as an independent contractor and don't withhold taxes, don't pay in payroll tax, and then the government later comes back and reclassifies that person as an employee, then they're going to owe a lot of back tax and a lot of high penalties. So it's really important to get the classification correct. And the main overall controlling factor of how you determine employee versus independent contractor comes down to control. So we have different types of control: behavioral, financial, and then control based on the relationship of the parties. But looking at the levels of control and how much control the employer has over the worker and how they do their job is really the key to unraveling whether you have an employee or an independent contractor. These are just very general steps for anyone that's interested in forming their own business, whether it's going to be as themselves as a sole practitioner or as someone who's going to employ other people. You run through these steps in order. Obviously, there are many that you can do yourself. There are others that I would recommend you using a professional advisor for. But the one near the top that I think is extremely important and probably the most important on this list for taxes is choosing the right business structure. And so we're going to spend time talking about what those different structure options are and the pluses and minuses for each one. But you first choose a business structure, and then you'll go through the steps of registering with the Secretary of State, getting an ID number. Once you have the ID number, then you can open a bank account. Once you have a bank account and have some funds in it, then you can get your business insurance. And then ultimately, when you get into the operational stage, is where you're going to look and choose which type of software or apps that you want to use for managing your finances and for calculating your taxable income. But again, the key here, I think, is choosing the right business structure. And this is a list of all the choices you have. And we'll go through each one and point out the favorable and unfavorable attributes of each type of business. So you can start by forming a sole proprietorship, where it's just you as an individual operating your company or your freelance projects or your work for hire type of things you can do as a sole proprietor. Or you can form one of these other entities like a C corporation or an S corporation or an LLC. But let's talk about what each of these means. So first is a sole proprietor. It's, I think, the simplest one to form, most straightforward in how it works. And it's basically done under your own personal name, unless you go and register a DBA for it, which is doing business as a certain name, or you form an LLC that you are the sole owner of. So if you form an LLC and you're the only owner, by default, it's treated as sole proprietorship, and it's essentially disregarded. It's as if it doesn't exist for federal tax purposes. Now, it still exists for state law, and you may get liability protection by having the LLC. But from a tax standpoint, it's as if it's not there, and everything gets taxed to you personally on your own personal tax return. So, and where we actually report that is called Schedule C of your tax return. So there's no separate return for the company, And a lot of times people don't like this because I think optically it looks as if you don't have a separate standalone liability protecting business, since on your taxes, everything's reported under your own name. So a lot of times people will do something different and we'll go through those options. Right before that, I do want to say there is no SALT workaround. What that means, and SALT stands for state and local tax. So there was a bill passed back in 2017 that took away the ability for people to deduct state taxes on their tax returns if they exceeded $10,000 of state tax. So before this law, if let's say you're in New York and you have to pay New York $20,000 in tax for the year, well, you used to be able to get a federal deduction for that $20,000, but the new law made it where you're limited to only $10,000 of deduction, no matter how much you pay in state tax. So what most states have done since then is created a SALT workaround system where they'll let you pay your state taxes and treat it as a business expense so you can deduct it from your business income. And then you get a credit on that state tax return for the amount your business paid on your behalf. So you get a credit that covers your state tax liability and you get a deduction on your federal return. So it's kind of a way to get around that $10,000 limit. And that's not available if you're a sole proprietor. Instead, you have to actually form a recognized or regarded entity, which we'll talk about in a minute. Before we get into those SALT workaround type entities, I want to start with the C corporation. So C corporation is the classic business model, the longest standing, the one that's been around for decades and decades. And why this is very helpful is because it provides liability protection for the owners. So a C corporation is treated as an entity separate and distinct from its owners, even if there's only one owner, and it stands alone on all tax matters. So it pays tax on its income at a rate of 21%, which is lower than other business forms. But the downside here with the C corporation is after it pays tax on its income itself, then when it sends the money out to the owner, so the owner wants to actually withdraw the money from the company, the owner has to pay tax again on that withdrawal. So we often refer to this as double taxation. So the C corporation gets taxed once, and then the individual gets taxed a second time when they take the money out. Now, that is obviously a huge consideration when you're forming your business. A lot of times people want to avoid the double taxation. But the positives here are that anyone can be a C corp owner, because as we'll see later, that's not the case in certain other types of companies. So anyone can own it. And then also, if it qualifies as a small business stock, so often abbreviated as a QSBS, if you hold your C corporation interest for 5 years and it qualifies as a small business stock, when you sell the stock, you can actually exclude the gain from income tax, up to $10 million of gain. So that's a huge advantage of a C corporation, is that you can sell it and potentially exclude a lot of gain from taxes, which you cannot do with other types of business entities. Partnership, this is different than an LLC, although an LLC can be treated as a partnership, which we'll talk about. But this is just a general partnership that's formed very easily by just making an agreement with someone else to do business together. So in order to have a partnership, you have to have at least two people or at least two entities, basically two owners or more, because if you only have one, it cannot be a partnership. The advantages here of a partnership are you get the liability protection for most, if not all, of the partners. There is no double tax like we talked about with C corporations. Instead, everything is only taxed once to the partners that own it. And you can potentially get either the SALT or the 199A deduction, or both. Another good thing about about partnerships is that anyone or anything can be a partner. Again, this is a little different in S-corps, which we'll talk about in a minute. But a big downside to partnerships are that the earnings are often subject to self-employment tax. So not only will you be paying income tax on any earnings of your partnership, you'll also be paying FICA, Medicare, so both the employee and employer's portion of the payroll taxes. And the other downside to partnerships is that the rules are very, very complicated compared to other types of business entities. And oftentimes they're complicated to the point that it's actually, it may incur more costs from a professional services standpoint, paying your CPA or your attorney to work on the tax matters that are inherent in the partnership structure. Now, what is probably the most popular form of business entity, especially for small businesses, is the S corporation. And this is a sort of a hybrid that gets you some of the best of both partnerships and C corporation worlds, but with some important distinctions. So one of the positives is that the S corp provides liability protection for all of the shareholders. So not just some, but all of them get liability protection. It avoids the double tax on S-Corp earnings. So in, the S-Corp itself does not pay tax in most cases. Instead, it passes its income through to the owners, and the owners then just pay one level of tax on the income. Now, an S-Corporation can be owned by only one person. So I think that's part of why it is one of the most common forms of business out there, is because just a single person can create an S-Corp and be the sole owner of it. The similar to a partnership, the S-Corp can potentially give you a SALT deduction or the 199A deduction. And just a reminder, 199A is the deduction that allows you to take 20% of your income off the top before you calculate your tax. So if your S Corp earned $100,000 of income, you get to deduct $20,000 and just pay tax on the $80,000. Great, great advantage to being an S Corp. Downsides are, I just have two downsides listed. One is that there are restrictions on who can be an owner. So generally, an S corporation can only be owned by US resident individuals. So it cannot be owned by other corporations or partnerships or people that are citizens and living outside of the US. But I mean, people that are not citizens of the US and are living outside of the US cannot be shareholders. So there are some restrictions on being an S corporation based on who can own it. And then also the rules are very rigid. So in one way, this is good because they're simpler than partnerships, because they are very rigid and straightforward. But at the other, I guess the downside of it is that there's, you lose a lot of flexibility and a lot of opportunities to do special allocations or certain types of planning that you can do in partnership world. The S corporation is very regimented in how its rules work, and there are not a lot of workarounds for it. And this leaves us with the last business entity choice, which is the LLC. An LLC can be many different things for tax purposes. So to have an LLC, you have to register it with your state, the state that you're forming it in. And once you do that, you then possibly have a choice in how it's going to be taxed. So as I mentioned earlier, if there is just one owner of the LLC, it's treated as a disregarded entity. It's as if the company does not exist for federal tax purposes. Everything gets reported directly by the owner themselves. If you have two or more members in the LLC, then the default treatment is it gets treated as a partnership for federal tax purposes. So it's subject to the potential self-employment tax and the ability to get a 199A deduction and a SALT deduction. So it gets all those characteristics of partnership tax. What you could also do with either with one member or with several is you can elect to be treated as a corporation instead of a partnership. So there's actually a form that you would file and you'd say, I have an LLC. I want it to be treated as a corporation. So I'm sending this form to tell the government that it should be treated as such. Not only that, you can decide to treat it as an S corporation. So an LLC can be disregarded. It can be a partnership. It can be a corporation, or it could be an S corporation. And so I think when you see companies that are formed and they say LLC at the end of them, they could be any of these types of business entities. There's not a way of knowing just from looking at the name of it, like there is with the other business types. Now, to get into a couple of general rules for actually running a business once you have it set up and established, I want to talk about revenue or income and expenses. So the default in the US tax system is that everything that your business receives is income. It's taxable income. So any type of, if you win a lawsuit and receive a settlement, or you win the lottery, or you sell a product and get paid for it, all those things are income and potentially taxable unless you can find a specific exclusion in the tax code that says this specific type of money or type of receipt is not taxable income. And some examples of things that are not are section 139F. And what that section relates to is settlements for wrongful imprisonment. So people that have been wrongfully convicted, sentenced to prison, ultimately get their convictions overturned and get released, a lot of times they receive compensation from the state or from some municipality for the wrongful imprisonment. That used to be subject, that settlement or that money that they receive used to be subject to tax until section 139F came out and said, actually, that particular type of income is not going to be taxable. Same thing with 104 deals with settlements for injury, personal injuries that can be excluded. But the takeaway for you here in general is that any type of property or money that the business receives is by default taxable income, unless we can find a specific rule that excludes it. And this means that even bartering for things creates taxable income. So even though you're not getting money, if you're getting some type of services in return for your services, that is that those services, the value of them should actually be included in taxable income. Now, on the flip side of that, where everything is income, by default, nothing is deductible. So any money that you spend, you hire someone to do some work, you buy inventory, all of those things are not deductible unless we can find a specific provision for it in the tax code. And a lot of those things that I mentioned, hiring somebody, buying goods that you're going to later sell, development costs for projects, those things are deductible because there are provisions in the code for it. But the starting point, the framework that we work with, is that nothing's deductible unless we can find it that it's provided for in the tax code. So keeping that in mind, I want to talk about the difference between deductions and credits. So deductions, which I have a list here of some common ones that you may encounter in your business, but deductions reduce the amount of income that's subject to tax versus credits that reduce the amount of tax itself. And some examples of deductions are software subscriptions, hosting fees, paying contractors for their development work. All those things create deductions that reduce taxable income. Separately, we have a whole system of tax credits that are available that some that are very common in software development companies. For example, the R&D credit is a very common one. And what a credit will do is it doesn't give you a deduction from income, but it reduces the amount of tax that you actually owe. So it's a dollar for dollar reduction of tax. To give you an example of that, if we say our business generates $100,000 of income, that's going to be taxable unless we can offset it with deductions. And let's say we have a $20,000 deduction as opposed to a $20,000 credit. So the $20,000 deduction would bring our income down from 100 to 80. And then assuming we're at a 25% tax rate, just pure assumption, that would create $20,000 of tax that's due on the $100,000 of income. Now, if we compare that to how a credit works, if we have a $20,000 credit, we don't get a deduction for it. So the whole $100,000 is subject to tax at our 25% rate equals $25,000 of tax that's due on the $100,000. But the credit then reduces that tax dollar for dollar. So we apply our $20,000 credit and we end up only owing $5,000. So while one, the deduction reduces taxable income, it's way less valuable than a credit. So whenever we can find opportunities to generate credits, whether it's there are credits for hiring certain employees, there are credits for operating in certain designated geographic zones, there are credits for buying solar equipment or electric vehicles, or for doing R&D work, which is software development fits right into, those credits are very, very valuable. And not only does the federal government give you tax credits, but states often follow the federal and have very similar credits as well. So again, here are some common expenses that you'll encounter. My advice is always to be very mindful and comb through where your money is going out to see if it can fit into a category that is allowed to be deducted. When you're operating your business, most things will, because even things like meals could fall into a deductible expense. Things like cell phones or home offices or mileage, traveling places, all those things can be tax deductions. I'm going to skip through some of the material about expenses, but it is, I think, very helpful information for you to take a look at. But because I want to talk about, with the bit of time we have remaining, something very, very important in particular to software development businesses, and that is research costs. So there is a section of the Internal Revenue Code. We refer to it as Section 174. And what it has done as of recent, so as of tax year 2022, is it has said that whenever you incur money for, or whenever you incur expenses related to research and experimental activities, instead of getting to deduct those costs, we have to treat them as an asset. So we book them on our books as an asset, and then we write them off over a period of years. I'll show you how this could be potentially, not to be extreme, but it could be a devastating tax result for software development companies if Section 174 has to continues to stay in existence the way it's written now. So before that, I will say that the research and experimental costs that you incur, which again, software development fits right into those, into that category of qualifying expenses, can qualify you for an R&D credit. And the credit is based on US, primarily US labor, so wages and 1099 contractors, people that you're employing to do research and experimental activities. The money that you spend to pay them is what can be used to generate an R&D tax credit that will reduce your tax liability. Now, getting into really how 174 though impacts your company, I just pulled some excerpts from the Internal Revenue Code, which you don't have to read in detail, but they're here to show you that what 174 now does is that instead of a deduction for research and experimental costs, we have to capitalize and then write them off over 5 years if they're US-based costs, or over 15 years if they're foreign-based costs. And what 174 says here is that software development, for the purposes of this section, any amount paid or incurred in connection with the development of any software shall be treated as a research or experimental expenditure. So this causes a situation where, let's say for an example, the business makes $100,000 in revenue, but it incurs $100,000 in software development costs to generate that revenue. So from a cash standpoint, we're at a break even. We took in $100,000 and we spent $100,000. So we should, you would think, since we have $0 left, that we would have zero tax due as well. But what happens under these rules is that instead of getting to immediately deduct the $100,000, we can only deduct a portion of it. And in this example, that portion is only $10,000 for the current year. And so you end up with taxable income of $90,000, which could result in, say, somewhere around $30,000 of tax with no money to pay the tax because you broke even. So very bad result there. The good news here is that there is a bill in Congress that would change this result and that it would go back to the old rules where we get to deduct the $100,000 of R&D expenses immediately instead of writing them off over a period of time. And that bill has passed the House and is now with the Senate to approve or not. And assuming that they do pass the bill, the way it's written now is it would be retroactive. So it would go back to 2022 and cover 2023 and then obviously going forward. So potentially a big, big change out there for companies like yours, where right now you're not able to deduct research and experimental / software development costs. But potentially that rule will change. So something to really pay attention to. I want to save a little bit of time for questions. And so I will talk about state income taxes for a few minutes, but just I'll try to limit it to about 4 or 5 minutes. And the important things that you need to know for state income taxes is that typically to be taxed by a state, there has to be some form of nexus, which means connection to that state. So let's say you create your development company in New York and you're operating in New York. You are subject to New York state tax. But let's say you then hire an employee who works in Massachusetts. Well, now having that employee in Massachusetts, which is considered a physical presence in that state, may subject you not only to New York tax, but now also to Massachusetts tax. And so something to be aware of is that having employees in other states might subject you to those other state taxes. But what some states do now is they say, you don't even need a physical presence to be taxed by us. Just an economic presence is sufficient. And by economic presence, they mean that you're doing a lot of sales or a lot of business in their state, even though you don't have a physical, like you're not renting property there, or you don't have employees there. But you're selling a lot to businesses or to people that are located in their state, they may say, well, now you have nexus and you need to be computing and paying income tax to our state as well. Now, there are with 50 states, many, many different iterations of how this works. Some states make a distinction between selling tax versus intangible goods. And some of them also make a distinction between selling products versus selling services and how they actually treat or consider you to have nexus or not based on what you're selling. And one other thing around this topic is, in order to determine, in my example, how much you owe Massachusetts, you need to apportion your income to that state. And a lot of times states do an apportionment calculation based on sales. So just based on sales in their state. But the question that comes up is, how do you know if a sale is generating, say, Massachusetts revenue or not? Well, some states look at where the end user benefits from your service or product. And if that end user is located, let's say in Massachusetts, that would be treated as Massachusetts revenue. Other states say, We're going to look at where the services are being performed. And if they're being performed in our state, so if the development work is being done in Massachusetts, then we're going to treat it as Massachusetts revenue. So you need to know, you need to actually have someone look at which states you're potentially connected to, then look at those states' specific rules for how they apportion income, and then determine if you have income that's subject to those states or not. So we're not going to do sales tax today, but you do have the materials you can look at. I just wanted to see if there are any questions that I can address before time is up. So Ashley, would you mind just letting me know or sharing with me?
Yep. Nope. You're good. Go ahead and take your slide down.
Okay.
So you can actually see the screen.
Got it.
All right. We have a lot of questions, but okay, we don't have a lot of time. So let's try to get through the ones that we can. All right. First up, from Mesh Mill on YouTube, what are the ways indies/freelance game developers can reduce their tax liability, e.g. types of deductions and credits?
Yeah, hopefully that was addressed in what I showed earlier, but it is through allowable expenses. Again, the initial starting point is that nothing's deductible unless it's specifically provided for. But I gave some examples of things that would reduce your liability. And I think the main credit that you would be looking at is the R&D credit. That is a really good way to reduce your tax liability. Now, if you're a relatively new business, so within your first 5 years of operations, and you don't have a tax liability because, let's say, you're operating at a loss, or you just don't have a lot of tax due from an income standpoint, you can use the R&D credit to offset payroll tax that you would have otherwise owed for your employees. So there are a couple of different ways to get a benefit from the R&D credit.
All right. Our next one is from Weston's World Studio on YouTube. Indie game devs, it's often $0 revenue for one or more years. Are deductibles due in any subsequent year or at any point?
Okay. So the way I'll approach this question is maybe to change. I don't know if this is exactly what you're asking, so I may be changing it a little. But if you're operating at a loss for a year or two or three, that loss isn't lost. That loss can carry forward. And then when you do become profitable and start making money and start having net income, you can use old losses to offset that current income and then reduce it down that way. So if you are operating at a negative, it's not like a waste of deductions. It can get used. It will just be in the future.
All right. We have another one from Weston Worlds. Business structure. Can I change entity type from sole proprietor to LLC before launch?
So in general, yes, you can. There are certain changes of forms, like going from a partnership to a corporation and going from an S corporation to a C corp. There are certain things that do have tax consequences. So it really needs to be evaluated depending on which form you're starting with and which one you're hoping to end up with. But generally, for a sole proprietor, to then become an LLC that's solely owned by that same person shouldn't cause any tax issues. So I would say, short answer, without knowing your specifics, probably you can do that without an issue.
Thank you for dealing with my brain lag. All right, we got another one on YouTube from Jeff. If you own an LLC, can you pay yourself as an employee and have the taxes withdrawn automatically?
That's a really good question. So the answer to that depends on which form your LLC is operating as. So if you remember, I showed one where it's just one owner and it's disregarded. Another option can be that the LLC is treated as a partnership. And the third is that it could be treated as a corporation or an S corp. If your LLC makes an election to be an S corporation, not only can you pay yourself wages, but you actually have to. You are supposed to pay yourself a reasonable salary as an S corporation owner. So in that situation, the LLC, yes, can pay wages to the owner and withhold taxes, also should do that. Separately, if you're an LLC that's treated as a partnership, in that situation, you're actually not allowed to pay yourself wages. So instead, you take all your money out as draws, and they're subject to income tax and they're subject to employment tax. So it depends. The answer to your question just depends on which form your LLC is taking.
All right, we have time for one more. Okay. From Meshmill on YouTube, if you're fundraising via investors, is it more cost effective to start as an LLC and turn it into a C Corp when an investor is willing to lead a round on your startup?
I like this question a lot because it's an important point that people should take away is that C corporations, because of the ability for anyone or anything to own it compared to S corporations, for example, C corporations are often a lot more attractive for investors. There are other reasons, especially related to foreign taxes, but C corporations are often more attractive to investors and can get you potentially good results when you sell the business as well. But to go to your question, I would need more specifics about what you have going on and if you've had losses in the past or not, because there could be tax consequences in going from an LLC that's not taxed as a corporation to one that is taxed as a corporation. So there could be a taxable event, but it really depends on specifics that you have. That's the best way I can answer that without knowing a little bit more about your situation.
Thank you so very much for your time and your lecture today, Daniel. We all really appreciate it. Next up, we have Michael Brown, founder of Vicarious PR, with his talk on unlocking wish lists through influencers in advertising. So stay put. We will be back. And for everybody who asked questions we didn't get to, we're very sorry. Daniel, are you in our Discord?
I'm not on Discord. If you go to my last slide, you can use the QR code or just use my email and send me your questions, and I'm happy to get back to you. Do you want me to?
No. Give me 1 second. Let's see if I can. Oh, my goodness. I'm talking and nobody can hear what I'm saying. I'm so sorry. There's the QR code, guys. Get it. If you miss it now, don't worry. The video is going to be up in like 2 seconds. We're going to pass it over to Dan now, and he's going to bring up Michael. Thank you so much, guys, and see you soon. All
right. Thank you.